From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point. A Marine officer in Vietnam, a top Justice Department official, an FBI director. Those are past roles for the man at center stage right now.
Robert Mueller has a message for President Trump.
President Trump's former National Security Advisor, General Michael Flynn, has told all to investigators.
Mueller has revealed that Flynn provided substantial assistance in at least three ongoing investigations.
But I'm going to tell you one thing I take away. There's about a size 16 shoe going to drop here.
This week, Special Counsel Robert Mueller urged a judge to spare President Trump's former National Security Advisor, General Mike Flynn, from prison time. Today, we learn more about the fates of the president's former personal lawyer and campaign chairman. Mueller's team has already filed nearly 200 criminal charges and secured three dozen indictments and guilty pleas. All the while, Trump has railed at Mueller at rallies, on Twitter, and on television. In April, Fox News' John Decker asked Trump, why don't you just fire Mueller?
Why don't I just fire Mueller? Well, I think it's a disgrace what's going on. We'll see what happens.
We sure will. This hour on Point, who is Robert Mueller? What makes him tick? And where's his investigation headed? Join us. I'm interested in what questions you have about the Mueller investigation and special prosecutor. Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. We have just the person to help sort through the questions on all this. With us from Vermont Public Radio in Rutland, Vermont, is Garrett Graff. Graff has been covering Mueller and his investigation for Wired and for Axios, and he wrote The Threat Matrix, Inside Robert Mueller's FBI and the War on Global Terror. You can read an excerpt of that book at our website at onpointradio.org. Garrett, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me, David.
So, Garrett, let's just first take a moment and recap a little bit. What have we been learning in recent days, last couple of weeks, that we didn't know?
The big one, obviously, was Michael Cohen saying, pleading guilty to lying to Congress.
The president's former personal lawyer.
Exactly. And sort of long time, decade long fixer of sorts. And Michael Cohen's plea agreement had to do with a specific set of lies around the Trump Tower Moscow project, which he had previously held ended in January 2016, but that he admitted in this plea agreement with Robert Mueller's office that actually continued well into at least June 2016, and that not only that, but he had actually had direct conversations about the project with the office of Russian President Vladimir Putin. And that rewrites the narrative that we understood about the Russian influence in the 2016 campaign in a couple of key ways. One, it shows us that Donald Trump was actively pursuing business arrangements with the Russian government while running for president and even while he was the presumptive Republican nominee. The second thing is it dramatically, I think, shifts the narrative around understanding everything that then comes after, which is, of course, June 2016, you have that very strange and still mostly unexplained meeting at Trump Tower with some Russians who are offering assistance, as well as meeting with Don Jr., Jared Kushner, and Paul Manafort to discuss what Russia might be doing to help. And the email that kicks this off is – has always been a suspicious part of this story because it says this meeting is part of the Russia's attempts to help the campaign. And it's never really known sort of what that meant. And now we have some understanding that there already had been some private back channel communications going on before then. And it also, remember, changes the way that we think about, for instance, Michael Flynn's role in this case. Michael Flynn's sentencing document also has come out recently and raised in some ways more questions than answers in that it had, as you were talking about in the last hour of the show, these big redacted sections about some ongoing investigations. But that had to do with
far more redactions than revelations, right?
Yes, except that the redactions in and of themselves are revelations. That it shows the depth of the cooperation that Michael Flynn has been providing, as well as helps us understand, you know, the general challenge with this whole Mueller investigation is we're looking at individual puzzle pieces without necessarily knowing how big the puzzle is, where the pieces that we're seeing fit in, nor even if we're looking at one interconnected puzzle or a couple of different puzzles. And one of the things I think those redactions show us is that perhaps this puzzle is bigger than we thought it was. If there are two investigations that have not yet become public that Mueller is pursuing, that Michael Flynn is talking about. But what the Cohen agreement reshapes in the context of Flynn is, remember, Flynn pled guilty ultimately to misleading federal investigators about this series of conversations that he had with Sergei Kislyak during the transition dealing with sanctions.
The ambassador. And,
Russian ambassador, Sergei Kislyak. Mm-hmm. And that one of the things that this Cohen plea agreement reshapes is our knowledge that by the time they get to that covert communication in December of 2016, the Russian government knows that the Trump campaign and now the Trump transition is quite comfortable having covert communications with the Russian government. And that they are comfortable misleading the public about them, and that they are comfortable outright lying about them. And that, I think, is actually a pretty significant way to rewrite and rethink Michael Flynn's case in the context of the case that we now know about Michael Cohen.
Well, let me stop you right there, because there are two things that you raise. One of which is the interconnectedness of the president's former lawyer and longtime advisor and his involvement, and also Michael Flynn, who was briefly a national security advisor for the Trump administration. Before that was a counselor, I think one of the only people under review who's played dual roles at the campaign and the administration. But last Thursday, President Trump accused Michael Cohen, this longtime advisor, of lying to federal prosecutors about the proposed real estate project in Russia. The president said the construction project in Russia was under consideration during the campaign, and that did not violate any rules.
We were thinking about building a building. I guess we had in a form. It was an option. I don't know what you'd call it. I decided ultimately not to do it. There would have been nothing wrong if I did do it. If I did do it, there would have been nothing wrong. That was my business.
Is there something wrong? Would there have been something wrong with President Trump striking a deal with the Russians legally while he was running for office?
Not if he had told people about it and they had been able to factor that into their decision to vote for him. I think that there are two things that you raise there that I think are significant to understanding the course of this investigation. One is just that fundamental question, which is, it is not inherently illegal to build a building in a foreign country. So if that was all that Donald Trump was doing, that's not inherently illegal. If that was all that they were doing, and they were totally comfortable with it, and as Donald Trump might say, they thought it was very cool and very legal, it seems quite strange that they then proceeded to lie about it for the better part of 2 years, thus creating leverage where the Russian government certainly knew that they were lying about it and have been lying about it in public and in closed-door sessions with congressional investigators and federal investigators over the last 2 years. And mm-hmm. that potentially sets up an incredible point of leverage. I mean, that in some ways is the worst-case counterintelligence scenario for a country, is to have a foreign government know something about your head of state that they don't want the public to know. And that's where we find that where we now understand Russia has known for 2 years that the Trump campaign, the Trump transition, and the Trump presidency, the Trump White House, have not been honest about their business dealings in Russia. Mm-hmm. Then the second part of this, David, I think, is that one of the questions before the Michael Flynn plea agreement is there has been a question of the interrelationship between, for instance, the Trump organization's business deals and the Trump attack on the Russian attack on the 2016 election, and whether those were entirely separate conversations, entirely separate investigations. And Michael Cohen brings them together in a big way, and it increasingly looks like they are one and the same, that there is no difference between the business collusion and the election collusion.
Wow, that's stark. We have a quick question for you from Cape Elizabeth, Maine. Emily, go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm curious what you think the direction of the investigation will go if President Trump's new nomination for Attorney General William Barr will go through. I know he's made some comments to the Washington Post in the past about being concerned about some of the people working on Mueller's investigation, campaign contributions they've made. And I do believe that Mueller actually worked under Barr back in HW's administration. So I'm curious what you think in terms of protections, would Barr potentially offer more protections than, say, Whitaker would?
Emily, let me throw that to Garrett Graff right now. Garrett, go ahead. We've got about 30 seconds left before the end of this segment.
Okay. Then I'll give you a very quick answer, which is I think ultimately this is all going to be decided, or we're at least going to know the outcome and direction of the Mueller probe long before Barr actually faces a confirmation hearing on Capitol Hill. That's not going to happen until early next year, and I think we're going to know a lot more in the next couple of weeks.
Bold prediction from Garrett Graff, a journalist who has spent more time with Robert Mueller in recent years than perhaps any other. We're talking, of course, about Robert Mueller, his special counsel, and his investigation. You can join our conversation. What do you want to know about the man himself? Do you think his investigation is going too far, taking too long, or just getting started? I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm David Folkenflik. We're talking about Special Counsel Robert Mueller and his investigation. You can join our conversation. We'll be taking your questions about all of this. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook and On Point Radio. With us from Rutland, Vermont is Garrett Graff, a historian, a journalist and contributor to Wired and Axios, and the author of several books, including The Threat Matrix, Inside Robert Mueller's FBI and the War on Global Terror. Garrett, this morning the president has been, shall we say, active on the Twitters. He's been talking a lot about Mueller, talking about what he contends are Robert Mueller's conflicts of interest, talking about various figures within the Justice Department who he feels have wronged him, including Rod Rosenstein, the deputy attorney general who appointed Mueller's special prosecutor. And we understand this morning that James Comey was grilled behind closed doors on Capitol Hill by House GOP. He, of course, was the former FBI director who had overseen this investigation until he was fired by the president. And on Capitol Hill, there seems to be a division not just between the parties, but even within the Republican Party itself, the president's own party, about how to think about the special prosecutor. Last week, Arizona Republican Senator Jeff Flake, a member of the Senate Judiciary Committee, declared he'll vote against advancing any of President Trump's judicial nominees until there's a floor vote to protect Mueller from any interference or from being fired by the acting attorney general, Matt Whitaker. Here's what Jeff Flake told fellow senators.
Some of my colleagues, as there hasn't been any indication that Mr. Mueller will be removed from office. But with the president tweeting on a regular basis, a daily basis, that the special counsel is conflicted, that he is leading so-called 12 angry Democrats and demeaning and ridiculing him in every way, to be so sanguine about the chances of him being fired is folly for us, I believe.
Now pair that with the comments of Trey Gowdy. He's the head of the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee. and a Republican from South Carolina. He's the head of that committee, at least until the new Congress takes over in January. He commented on the duration of the Mueller investigation and said, Russia isn't being hurt by this investigation right now. We are.
This country is being hurt by it. We are being divided. We've seen the bias. We've seen the bias. We need to see the evidence. If you have evidence of wrongdoing by any member of the Trump campaign, present it to the damn grand jury. If you have evidence that this president acted inappropriately, present it to the American people. There's an old saying that justice delayed is justice denied. I think right now all of us are being denied. Whatever you got, finish it the hell up, because this country is being torn apart.
Garrett Graff, as a journalist, how do you respond to the characterization Trey Gowdy made right there?
Well, I definitely do think the Russian attack on the election has been divisive in the United States. I think it's important, though, to stay focused on the fact that this was an unprecedented attack by our nation's leading historic adversary on the core foundation of the American system, our democracy and our election and really our America's confidence in itself. And that this investigation for a federal investigation has actually moved very quickly. We're about 17 months into Mueller's time as special counsel. And as you said at the top of the show, he's brought several hundred criminal charges and about three dozen indictments and guilty pleas, and has already shown us that the president's campaign chairman, the top foreign policy aide and national security advisor, the deputy campaign chairman, working as unregistered foreign agents of foreign governments during their time on the campaign, and that all of them have been either pleaded guilty or found guilty at trial for a pretty unprecedented set of crimes. Mueller has laid out in this case, and he's been very focused from the beginning, and I think it's important to understand the structure of this investigation, that we talk about it as the Mueller probe, but it's really five, almost six distinct investigations and investigative avenues. And so Mueller has laid out the four corners of the 2016 investigation, and that's money laundering and past business deals, as you saw him charge Rick Gates and Paul Manafort.
That's the deputy campaign chairman and the chairman, as we said earlier.
Exactly. And then he has laid out and charged a group of Russians working for the Internet Research Agency for their information influence operations targeting the 2016 election. Mm-hmm. He's charged another set of Russians working for the military intelligence agency, GRU, for their active cyber penetrations and intrusions and the theft of DNC emails and their attacks and attempts to hack state-level voting systems. And then the fourth corner of that 2016 investigation is this question of the Russian Trump campaign and transition contacts. And that is everything from, we now know, Michael Cohen and the Trump Tower Moscow deal, to Michael Flynn's conversations with Ambassador Sergei Kislyak, to that still unexplained Trump Tower meeting in June 2016, and some other sort of strange questions about, you know, how and why was there an attempt to weaken the GOP's platform at the Republican National Convention to make it more pro-Russia and less anti-Ukraine.
It all seems to go in one direction, right?
It all goes in one direction. And that's, yeah. Those four corners represent the 2016 investigation. And what Mueller is beginning to do now is fill in the space in between that. Then you have two other buckets of investigation. One, the big kahuna question of whether the president either did or attempted to obstruct justice through his firing of FBI Director Jim Comey and pressuring Jim Comey to drop the investigation into Flynn, or through any of the other actions that the president has taken, you know, up to and including some of his recent tweets trying to discourage people from cooperating with a special counsel. And then this last bucket of investigation that is relatively new and is being primarily run not by Mueller's office but by the federal prosecutors in the Southern District of New York, looks at Michael Cohen and Donald Trump's campaign finance violations in during the 2016 campaign that involve paying hush money to some women to avoid some salacious details coming out in the weeks prior to the election. And that includes what do
Stormy
I describe
Daniels
her?
Yeah, Stormy Daniels. Yeah. It really is kind of like one of those magic eight balls, you know, of scandals where you shake it and another one comes to the surface and lights up, right? Speaking of some of these investigations, Garrett, we have a question about that from Danny. He's calling from Cleveland, Ohio. Danny, go ahead with your question for Garrett.
Hi, David. I was actually wondering about the 12 angry Democrats. Is that demonstrably provable or is it demonstrably false? And also about the $52 million penthouse that was promised in the negotiations with Russia to President Vladimir Putin.
If I understand, Danny, if I understand correctly, you're saying the president's allegations, this thing is just being run by Democrats and somehow, you know, Bob Mueller is some sort of a phantom Democrat. Is there any truth to this? Can this be shown to be true or untrue, right?
Yes.
Okay. We'll take those questions for Garrett Graff right now. Thanks so much for asking him, Danny. What about it, Garrett Graff?
So a couple of things to understand. The first is, you know, Bob Mueller has assembled what is perhaps the most talented team of federal prosecutors ever assembled inside the Justice Department on a single case. And it includes folks like Aaron Zebley, who was his former chief of staff at the FBI, and who was one of the agents working and chasing al-Qaeda actually even before 9/11. And Aaron and his partner Steve Gauden were instrumental in capturing one of the al-Qaeda bomb makers who targeted the U.S. embassies in Kenya and Tanzania in 1998. And they went undercover in South Africa to capture him. And then it includes folks like James Quarles, who was actually one of the original Watergate prosecutors. It involves Michael Dreeben, who is a longtime Justice Department appellate lawyer, perhaps the most skilled appellate lawyer in the U.S. government and one of the best in the entire country on either the defense or prosecution side. And that this is a team of people who have dedicated, you know, collectively decades of their life to the Justice Department and to being federal prosecutors. And where Donald Trump gets this idea of the 17 angry Democrats is that some of them made relatively small contributions to Hillary Clinton or other campaigns, Democratic campaigns over the years. But one of the important things to understand is that under civil service law, Bob Mueller is actually legally not allowed to consider donation history in making his hiring decisions.
Under the letter of the law.
Under the letter of the law. In civil service, you can't look at whether someone is a Democrat or a Republican prior to hiring them.
And so as Washington goes, these people are seen as professional legal figures and not as professional partisan figures.
Exactly. And so this is a very talented, a very apolitical, nonpartisan group.
So let's take a look at Robert Mueller just for a moment. You've written so much about his life and his career. Let's take a look at him as a public servant. Bob Mueller has spoken over the years about the importance to him about public service and particularly about trying to protect the public. A little bit before he was appointed special counsel last year, Mueller was praised on the Alan Harbor show for helping to prevent attacks while heading the FBI. And instead of like absorbing that and basking in that, he actually expressed anguish at the attacks that the FBI was not able to prevent.
We weren't successful 100% of the time. We had Fort Hood, where Major Hassan killed 13 people. And quite obviously, and notably, we had the Boston Marathon bombings. And every time you have something like that, you instinctually, you spend a lot of time with the victims and their families. And so it sears you when you don't stop an attack.
That was Bob Mueller's voice you were hearing on the Aaron Harbor show. You don't hear his voice a lot. He doesn't talk publicly a lot these days. But Garrett Graff, you've looked back at his career both at the Department of Justice, at the FBI, and also in Vietnam. What strikes you as formative moments that people should know about to help understand this person playing such an important role right now?
Yeah. The most important thing, I think, is to understand that for Bob Mueller, this job leading the special counsel's office in what is certainly one of the most controversial, high-profile, and perhaps most consequential investigations by the Justice Department in its entire 150-year history, is probably, for him, only the third hardest job he has ever had. And let me explain what I mean by that.
Yeah.
He graduated from Princeton in the spring of 1966 and enlisted in the Marines at a time in the Vietnam War when people like him didn't need to enlist in the Marines. And certainly people like him didn't end up leading Marine infantry platoons in combat in Vietnam. And next week, December 11th, will actually be the 50th anniversary of the battle that shaped him perhaps more than any other experience that he had in Vietnam. It was a battle for a hill known as Mutter's Ridge. And he led his Marine platoon up this hill in Mutter's Ridge along the DMZ, which was some of the most intense fighting that the U.S. saw in the entire Vietnam War was along the DMZ during that period in Quang Tri province. And Mueller, on December 11th, 1968, led his platoon to rescue an ambushed platoon of a neighboring company atop Mutter's Ridge and ended up taking heavy fire from more than 200 North Vietnamese Army regulars. And in a day-long firefight, ended up rescuing the history had shown one injured Marine, one mortally injured Marine. And I actually found this year when I dove into the story that Mueller actually rescued two injured Marines that day. I found the second one alive in Texas, Willie Sparks. And that Mueller went down into enemy territory, rescued them both, and brought them back to U.S. lines and received for his actions that day the Bronze Star with Valor. A few months later, in April 1969, he was shot himself through the thigh, medevaced out of the jungle in Vietnam, and served out the last 6 months of his tour working as a staff aide. Came back to the United States and has spent most of the rest of his career as a Justice Department prosecutor, ultimately ending up as the FBI director on September 4th, 2001. So on his seventh day, he was sitting down to a briefing in the seventh floor director's conference room of the FBI headquarters and it was his first briefing on Al-Qaeda and the bombing of the USS Cole when he was interrupted with word of the 9/11 attacks and then proceeded to lead the FBI in the minutes, hours, days, weeks, months, and ultimately 12 years after 9/11. And I think if you were able to ever get Bob Mueller to talk in a reflective moment, he would say that both the experience in Vietnam and the experience leading the FBI after 9/11 were harder than what he is doing today. And that he used to joke as FBI director, as hard as it was, I'm still getting more sleep here than I ever did in Vietnam. And I think he probably thinks the same thing today.
You're hearing there the voice of Garrett Graff, a journalist who has covered the life and career of special counsel Robert Mueller. We're talking about Mueller and his investigation into Russian interference in the 2016 election and the ties of the Russians with the world of Donald Trump. You can join the conversation. Does this feel to you like politics, like principle, or law? Me, I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Do you find yourself searching for true crime podcasts that are different from what you're always recommended? Do you want to make a real difference in the cases that you're following? Well, you're a crime junkie, and I'm Ashley Flowers, the creator and host of the number one true crime podcast, Crime Junkie. There are hundreds of episodes already available, and each Monday we dive into the details of cases spanning from some of the most infamous to those that you have never heard covered before. Listen to Crime Junkie podcast now, wherever you're listening.
Smart journalism, fascinating topics. Words that describe CNN's podcast, The Assignment with Audie Cornish.
Last year, the Army missed its recruitment goal. It had 65,000 spots to fill and came up 10,000 short of that target. Why is it so hard to recruit? How's the Pentagon responding? And how are the voices of service members on social media shifting the balance?
Listen to The Assignment with Audie Cornish wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. We're talking about Robert Mueller's investigation into Russian interference in the 2016 election and its reach all the way around the world and deep into Washington. The question, of course, of the ties into Trump world. You can join the conversation. What questions do you have about the investigation? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. We're talking to Garrett Graff, the historian, journalist, a contributor to Wired and Axios, author of several books, including The Threat Matrix, Inside Robert Mueller's FBI, and The War on Global Terror. There's one anecdote I came across, and I can't remember whether it's in your book or in your subsequent articles, but you talked about how he basically served for many years, public servant. He serves as a prosecutor, rising in a variety of ways, serves as a major player in the Justice Department under President George H.W. Bush, leaves for a cushy defense job and says, this isn't for me. What does he do then?
So this was right after the end of the Bush 41 administration. He's forced out by the change of administrations. He was the assistant attorney general for the criminal division, actually under Attorney General Barr, who has, as of this week, been re-nominated to become Attorney General again.
It's like Don Rumsfeld.
Exactly. And he goes into private practice, as you said, to be a white-collar defense attorney, which is what you normally do after you serve at the top rungs of the Justice Department. And he just hates it. And I've talked to a lot of people who worked with him during that era, and they all have some version of the same story, which is something along the lines of they bring in a new client to meet with Mueller. Mueller sits there, listens to the client lay out their problems, and then Mueller, remember, the defense attorney, says, well, if you did that, it sounds like you should plead guilty and go to prison. And that's really not the full-throated defense that most people are looking for from their high-priced
defense attorneys. It's not what you're paying $400 an hour for, right?
Exactly. And so he ends up calling then U.S. Attorney for the District of Columbia, Eric Holder, and asking to come back as a line prosecutor in the U.S. Attorney's office in D.C., which is
basically the D.A. in any other city.
Exactly. It is a state or local prosecutor in any other area. And so Mueller, who had up until, a year and a half earlier, led the entire 40,000-person criminal division of the Justice Department, which is in government terms the equivalent of a three-star general, steps down and then re-enlists in the Justice Department as the equivalent of a second lieutenant and is working homicide cases alongside people, 3-4 years out of law school. And then sort of proceeds in the Clinton administration to work his way up through the ranks of the Justice Department again until George W. Bush makes him the acting deputy attorney general at the start of his administration in 2001. So this is someone who has held and been appointed to top positions by all five of the most recent presidents on both sides of the aisle. And has really sort of worked his way to the top of the Justice Department not once but twice, and is really sort of the only person, you might say, until Attorney General Barr, who has done that twice.
Just briefly, I mean, in some ways I love this about the guy. I love the anecdote, and you write admiringly about this. On the other hand, if he really is a hammer, does everything begin to look like a nail? Is there a bit of a danger there?
So I don't think it's so much that. It's he is not a overly zealous prosecutor. He is someone who has an incredibly straightforward sense of right and wrong, and that he has and has always had a relatively black and white approach to a moral compass. You know, he grew up in a household in suburban Pennsylvania in Villanova, and the son of a Navy captain from World War II, submarine, the head of a submarine chaser, or captain of a submarine chaser, who then went on to become a DuPont executive. And he's always talked about how his father instilled in him this incredibly clear moral compass. And his line to me was, "The one thing you didn't do before my father was shade the truth. A lie was the worst sin." That's a direct quote from Mueller to me in talking about sort of how he was shaped as a child.
I think there was also one line where you said it was a very funny line, but you said in a piece you wrote about his service in Vietnam that an officer candidate school, the only D he received was for delegation. I wonder if that had any bearing. I don't want to spend too long on this, but nonetheless, there was this incident or this episode of post 9/11, right in the heat of anxiety about American security. Mueller is at the head of the FBI, effectively helping to oversee our approach to that for the FBI, but also approach to concerns about domestic terrorism, the anthrax attacks. And the FBI couldn't have gotten that more wrong.
Yeah. And when you look at the look at Mueller's career in total and then his time at the FBI, certainly the anthrax attacks is one of the darkest stains, and was for him as well. You know, he was very frustrated with the handling of that case, and George W. Bush used to not so nicely tease him during their morning terrorism briefings, you know, where for years he would needle Mueller by saying, "How's that anthrax case coming along?" obviously the FBI got the first iteration of that case wrong. But I think one of the things that is interesting about the way that the FBI ultimately solved that case was they ended up having to solve it by developing science and technology that didn't exist at the time of the attacks. So it wasn't that they—
Fascinating.
It wasn't that they sort of screwed up in a way that they went back and fixed. They screwed up and then had to go out and invent a new way to figure out what the right answer was.
Sure. We've got a lot of calls for you. Let's take a call now from Sarasota, Florida. Jim, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey, I totally disagree with what you said earlier about, you know, if Trump told everybody about that Trump Tower proposal in Russia— with the Kremlin, that it would possibly be okay. I call it treason, and I'll tell you why. If you look at the definition of treason, and then you think about what this guy's done, in 2016, Russia, Putin indirectly, after invading Ukraine, a sovereign country, and then the Malaysian aircraft that went down with 80 children on board and tied to Putin, and then them lying and having, you know, Martians in black suits down there saying that they weren't Russians, and then Obama puts sanctions on them. If Trump worked out a deal and got Flynn to say, "Don't worry about those sanctions, we're going to get rid of them once we get in office," and also suggesting that you know, if you give us incentives with the Trump Tower, you know, after at the same time, Russia is attacking our power grids, our financial infrastructure, banks, attacking our voting system. And, you know, they attack democracy in general. So if he's dealing with them and they're attacking us at the same time, how can you not think that that's treason?
Thank you for that, Jim. I think you're raising a lot of important questions, a lot of episodes, but there's a lot of truth in what Jim's saying in terms of the factuality of those episodes. Is there if Trump were to be shown to be actively working together, after all, there was the incident where former General Mike Flynn, his advisor, appears at this RT conference that he was paid to go to and some questions about what that means, RT being, you know, Russia Today, the Russian broadcaster controlled by the Kremlin. You know, what legal exposure is there for the president under the Mueller investigation if there is shown to be more direct collaboration between Trump's associates and the Kremlin itself?
And I think that that's where the caller absolutely is correct. And I wasn't in any way trying to defend the idea of doing a business deal in Moscow. The simple fact that they were trying to do it is not illegal. There are plenty of questions about whether the behavior and activity surrounding it was illegal. And particularly at that intersection of the sanctions that came into effect after the invasion of Ukraine, and whether the deal might have actually had to do with lifting sanctions, and one of the callers earlier actually sort of referenced this obliquely. There has been some separate reporting by BuzzFeed that there was a idea to offer Vladimir Putin himself for free the penthouse of Trump Tower Moscow, which certainly could appear to be a violation of the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act that prohibits U.S. companies from corruption overseas.
Giving bribes to get business, basically.
Exactly. And so there are plenty of legal questions still surrounding the Trump Tower Moscow deal, and certainly the behavior of the Trump campaign throughout. I was trying to say that the fundamental question of pursuing an overseas business deal while being a presidential candidate, there's nothing inherently illegal in that single fact. The set of facts that we now understand about this raises plenty of questions about the illegality of the behavior that was taking place at the time, and certainly the totality of what we know about the Russian interaction coming our direction raises some serious questions. I mean, I think the clearest and sharpest way to look at this is that Michael Cohen's plea agreement last week made clear that Bob Mueller has outlined two criminal conspiracies over the last 17 months. One dealt with Russia's attack on the 2016 campaign, and the other dealt with Michael Cohen and Donald Trump's campaign finance violations. And with Michael Cohen's plea agreement, we now have the central figure of one of those criminal conspiracies was in contact and seeking the assistance of and seeking the help of the central figure in the other criminal conspiracy, Vladimir Putin, and that is where these stories begin to wrap themselves together very quickly.
I want to get at one question I get asked by a lot. My dad and I talk about this stuff, and it's how important are things that play out in public view on the one hand, and also to what extent is Mueller able to expand his aperture a bit? That is, if you look at the things that the president has said about, for example, Saudi Arabia in the face of overwhelming evidence of the crown prince's involvement in the killing of a journalist who was writing for the Washington Post. And you also look at revelations about the president's, you know, he talks about America's business dealings with the Saudis, but his company's his private business dealings with the Saudis that significantly aided the Trump organization's bottom line. Are the kinds of things that the president says in public in some ways legally complicating for him? And are these areas that the special prosecutor can decide to go into even though they aren't under the original purview of the Russia framing of the investigation?
the first question, or the quickest answer to that is, I don't know that we know yet that they are not under the purview of the special counsel's original investigation and his mandate. I do think it is worth noting that the two places where President Trump's personal views and actions are foreign policy-wise are most at odds with the U.S. government's approach are on Saudi Arabia and Russia, where Donald Trump has the most business deals underway. I would argue that's probably why the founders put into the Constitution the emoluments clause that is up for constitutional debate right now of whether the president is actually prohibited from profiting from foreign countries during his time in office. So that's sort of one set of one answer to your question. To the first half about sort of what the president is doing in public view, I think this really is something. And David, I think you know you're a media reporter, so this is a really interesting and juicy question on your beat. I think the media has struggled to adjust to obstruction of justice and witness tampering that takes place in the open, that a lot of these tweets that we see come out from the White House, from the president, if we learned that they were being said in, private telephone calls to the Justice Department, or they were being written on notes and slipped under Jeff Sessions' door, we really need to immediately launch an investigation of Hillary Clinton, his words in recent days backing up Roger Stone for staying strong and not speaking and not cooperating to the special counsel's office. In a lot of these cases, it seems like we are seeing obstruction of justice at a mass scale, instantly viewable by anyone on Twitter.
It is the unfathomable thing where it's visible to the eye, whereas if you've obtained it in an email as a reporter, you'd be like, look, I got this. And instead, just being broadcast to the world.
And we're sort of numb to it in a way that I think we should not be because, you're just not used to watching a criminal conspiracy play out for everyone to read in real time.
And that is, I guess, the challenge facing Robert Mueller to tie together the loose strands playing out in front of us in real time and all the things he's able to secure behind the scenes. That will be our final word for this hour, although it's an ongoing story. You've been hearing the insights and reporting of Garrett Graff, a contributor to Wired and Axios, author of several compelling books, including The Threat Matrix, Inside Robert Mueller's FBI, and The War on Global Terror. Garrett, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
I'd love for everyone to continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. On Point is produced by Anna Bauman, Brian Hartzinski, Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsonis, Barkley Palmer, Allison Poli, James Ross, Alex Schroeder, and Gretchen Voss, with help from Madeline D'Angelo and Lexi Puri. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.